I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, for some people, it's brushing the dog hair off the sofa. For others, it's putting the last bit of garnish on the cheese plate or fixing their hair in the mirror. Those little rituals we do before we welcome guests into our home, allowing our own private space to be transformed into a different universe with different rules. See, those rules of social etiquette have changed dramatically since the time our ancestors used to gather around the campfire and lunge for that little piece of meat roasting on the spit. Well, for some, I guess nothing has changed since those days, but we all need help knowing what's acceptable behavior, how to defend our food and guard our territory when we all gather to socialize. No wonder sometimes there are rough beginnings.
Oh, Mr. Driftwood.
Ah, Gottlieb, allow me. Mrs. Claypool, Mr. Gottlieb. Mr. Gottlieb, Mrs. Claypool. Mrs. Claypool, Mr. Gottlieb. Mr. Gottlieb, Mrs. Claypool. Mrs. Claypool, I could go on like this all night, but it's tough on my suspenders.
Thank you, Mrs. Higgins. May I introduce Miss Eliza Doolittle?
My dear Miss Doolittle, how kind of you to let me come. Delighted, my dear. Lady Boxington, how do you do? How do you do?
Fine. And over here, Senator and Mrs. Hedges.
Senator, good to see
you.
Yeah,
good to see you.
Hi, how are you? Billy, this is Senator Hedges.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Mrs. Claypool, Mr. Gottlieb, Mr. Gottlieb, Mrs. Claypool, Mrs. Claypool, Mr. Gottlieb, Mr. Claypool. Now, if you four people want to play bridge, don't mind me. Go right ahead.
Today on The Connection, a conversation about just how well the old rules of etiquette are still holding up, what's changing, and how much did that gravy boat cost anyway? This is a special pre-recorded broadcast of The Connection. We won't be taking your phone calls. What am I saying? You don't have time to call anyway. You have to dust the glasses, iron the napkins, and disinfect the hamster cage before tonight's party. That gives me time to open the Connection door to the three guests who will be here for the next hour. Sally Quinn is joining us from Washington. For years, she covered the social scene in the Capitol. She's also an author and currently a reporter with The Washington Post. Sally, it's nice to have you here.
Great to be here.
Martin Boo joins us from the studios of KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He's a contributor to the Los Angeles Times Magazine and to Bon Appetit. He writes about food and hospitality and etiquette. Martin, thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
And Jesse Browner is in a studio in New York. He is author of a new book called The Duchess Who Wouldn't Sit Down, An Informal History of Hospitality. He's also a fiction writer and a translator. Jesse, nice to have you with us.
I'm very happy to be here.
Now, I have to ask the three of you, just off the top, as I was listening to myself introduce you, should we do more of that at a party when somebody comes in the door? Should we say, Sally Quinn, it's so nice to have you. She covered the social scene. She's currently a reporter with the Washington Post. I always feel like we never really know how much to say or not to say when we're introducing one person to another person. What are the rules here, Sally?
Well, I am a big believer in introducing people with some sort of a little bio or resume. And I know in Europe, that's considered very rude, that people don't like to be told what they do or what other people do. And I think their attitude is we should be welcome as a person in our own right rather than just by our titles or by our jobs. But my feeling is that it makes the conversation so much easier if you say, this is John, and he works at Newsweek, and this is Ralph, and he's an investment banker with such and such. Then they immediately have something that they can latch onto rather than the weather. And I think it makes conversations sparkle right away and gives people, if you'll pardon the expression, a connection to each other that they would sometimes take half an hour or they may never get to for the evening. I mean, I've had people come running over to me at the end of the evening and say, oh, my God, you know, you're the one who blah, blah, blah. And it was such a waste of time if you know, people don't want to brag about who they are or what they do, so they're sort of reticent about it. But if the hostess can sort of say something, this is Mary, she likes to garden. This is John, he has one of the most beautiful gardens I know, that kind of thing. It doesn't necessarily have to be what you do, but it should be something about the person that will be able to have them hook up in some way.
Martin, does it work that way on the West Coast?
Well, no. It can. I think, you know, I kind of sort of moved through two different parallel universes here, and I'm very well acquainted with the stripe of host who not only refuses to introduce his guest, he gets rather irate with them when they introduce themselves to each other. Now, I've never quite figured out how to navigate this myself. I'm a little bit shy about asking the question, what do you do? Because in a town like this, people immediately assume you're trying to find out if they're a movie producer and if you're trying to push their screenplay on you. But I find it a little hard to navigate a conversation without a little something to go on. So I agree completely with Sally. I had a friend who since moved to New York, who just had this wonderful knack for, without getting too biographical or too much into the resume, would say it's like, you know, Janine, you and John have both been to Thailand and love Asian cooking, and some kind of semi-personal detail like that can just really get you off and running.
Mm-hmm. And Jesse, how would you do this if you were having people in New York? Have you got rules that you follow?
New York is kind of particular because it's such a tiny town, really. You know, I stroll around my neighborhood and I know everybody. People think of New York as a big impersonal place. But the fact is that 9 times out of 10, people know who each other are before they even arrive at our door. Everybody's very curious. They usually call up ahead of time to ask who's going to be there. So then by
is
the time
polite?
They arrive at the
door... Can I interrupt for a minute? Is that polite to call and ask who else is going to come to the party? I wanted to do it once or twice and thought to myself, I'm going to sound like I won't come if I don't like the list of people.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it's kind of rude if you end up not showing up afterwards. So if you're going to make the effort to ask, you'd better arrive there.
I've had several politicians have their staff call and say, we'd like to know the senator or the secretary, whoever is... It would like to make a drop by, but wants to see the guest list first. And
is that for homework purposes, Sally, or for
I basically say no. I mean, you can come or not come. But then they say, well, you know, the senators are afraid, or whoever is afraid, that he won't know people, and that it'll be embarrassing to him. And if he knows they're going to be there, he'll recognize them. And so the last time this happened, and it's the last time I've ever done it, I sent it. This is a member of the cabinet. I sent the guest list, faxed the guest list, and the guy didn't show up.
Hey, you know what the most sinister development on that front is?
What, Martin?
The Evite. Do they have Evite? I'm sure that at the level Sally's entertaining at, you don't do this with Evites. But an Evite, in case you haven't gotten one, is a prepackaged email that gives you a link with an invitation to the party. And I just I hadn't paid much attention to these till recently, but I got a couple just a couple of weeks ago. And what's kind of awful about this is that you click on and you say whether you're coming, and you're kind of encouraged to make a pithy, pseudo-enthusiastic remark about how much you're looking forward to being there. And the result being that I pride myself at showing up to places where I say I'm going to be, but I started looking at this roster of people who are going to be there, and they were all plus one, and I didn't have a date that night. It was going to be a bunch of boring couples, so I didn't go. So this is the end of civilization.
Sally, did you ever use an Evite?
Well, I certainly have not sent them, and I find them very complicated to open. I can't quite get them open. They always have some music, and I just figure... if they really want me there, they'll either have to call or send something in the mail that I can negotiate.
And Jesse, this is I don't know. I mean, if I pick up where you left off with something slightly more intimate, I would think that the Evite would be somewhat frowned upon in a smaller circle. No.
Well, I have to say I've never seen one, but then I'm a novelist, so I don't get too many invitations anyway.
Assume that all of your guests are computer literate and really computer literate, and that they also open their emails all the time.
But you know, among publishing types, they're a little bit technologically backward. I know several people who don't even know how to open their emails. So,
but that's what I'm saying. If you're going to send one of those, you're assuming that everybody is computer literate, and I think, as you say, particularly in among writers, that's not necessarily true.
Let me ask you all about the way that we define etiquette. Jesse, you talk about it as almost a transaction. Is that your word?
Yes, that is my word. I wouldn't apply it directly to etiquette, but to hospitality in general.
Okay.
It's a sort of a subliminal transaction, I think, where the host is actually seeking to benefit every bit as much as the guest is. Etiquette is simply the language in which they speak to one another. It's kind of codified. And I don't think it has very much place in the modern world, except, of course, if you have cabinet members coming to your home.
You mean the language, the codification, doesn't have much place in the world? I mean, I'm trying to think of something as simple as, when am I supposed to show up for a dinner invitation that says 8 o'clock? I mean, Martin, something in etiquette tells me that what's too early and what's too late there, right?
Yeah, I think you've got to make kind of an intuitive calculation about the habits of your host, because if it's a couple with children, they probably 8 probably means pretty close to 8.
8:02.
Yeah, you know, if it's a single depressed person, like whenever, you know, just as long as you show up with a lot of beer.
Sally, with a larger gathering, what do you think?
I think usually if you're invited for a dinner at 8, I think 8:15 is a good time to show up. A lot of people aren't ready at 8. You know, there's always this sort of last minute rushing around the kitchen and fixing your hair and turning the lamps on and, you know, whatever.
What's too late, though?
Huh?
What's too late? I mean, the 15
Anything
minutes
more
after.
More than a half an hour is too late. So I think between 8:15 and 8:30 is a good time to show up.
What do you think, Jesse? Does that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we generally don't sit down to dinner until 9:30 or 10 o'clock. So if somebody were to show up at 9, I wouldn't mind. I personally wouldn't do it.
Would you expect that person to call ahead and say, I'm going to be there?
If you're asked for 8, you don't serve dinner until 10?
Generally,
isn't everybody so drunk they're not able to eat anymore?
Well, that's kind of part of the idea.
The ritual.
You know, there's always something out on the table. Excuse me?
Aren't they all drunk by the time they eat?
Well, that's what I just asked.
Oh, I'm sorry.
People would be so sloshed they wouldn't. Maybe you don't serve. But.
It's actually an interesting thing about dinner parties in. Where did I stumble? In New Delhi. I lived there for a while, and that's exactly what happens. You're invited for dinner at 8 o'clock. Dinner isn't served till 11:30 or 12. And the way that you depart the party is you take your empty plate and hand it to someone in a line as you say goodbye to the host or the hostess. So everybody is completely plastered by the time they finally get to their food. I mean, only by
I
way
of... half an hour to 45 minutes of cocktails is plenty so that... I invite people for 8. They come at 8:15, and I never serve dinner later than 9:15, usually between 9 and 9:15. So I just think there's too much standing around. I get bored and antsy if I have to stand around too long drinking. And then, you know, there are a lot of people in Washington who don't drink anymore because they have to get up so early the next day or, you know, they want to be clear-headed at dinner because whatever they might say could end up in the paper the next day.
God, that's changed. When I used to work on Capitol Hill a long, long time ago, and a hangover was considered a legitimate excuse for not showing up for work. It was like calling
it
sick.
Things have changed. Definitely changed.
I make my guests sign a release before they arrive. They have to promise to drink a bare minimum, or else the whole party will be a washout. But perhaps I was exaggerating when I said 10 o'clock, but certainly if somebody arrived by 9, I wouldn't be offended.
Questions of Etiquette, this hour in the New Year's Eve edition of The Connection. We're back after this short break with more of the things that you really, really wanted to know but were always afraid to ask with people who have the answers. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to a special New Year's Eve edition of The Connection. Now, think back a little bit. In the movie, Dinner at 8, okay, think back a long way, 1933, Billy Burke plays a Park Avenue hostess who tries, with some manipulation, to pull together a dinner party for an aristocratic English couple. And this is how she sounds just an hour before dinner.
I've had the most ghastly day anybody ever had. No aspic for dinner, and a new butler tonight, and that dance woman coming in, and having to send for crab meat. Crab meat! And now, on top of everything else, the Ferncliffs aren't coming to dinner. They call up at this hour, the miserable Cockneys. They call up to say they've gone to Florida. Florida! And who can I get at this hour? Nobody! I've got 8 people for dinner. 8 people isn't a dinner. Who can I get?
And this is how one of her fill-in prospective guests sounds just an hour later.
Now, Ed, it isn't going to be so terrible.
Not so terrible. Get into this uniform to meet a bunch of fatheads I don't want to know and miss that Greta Garbo picture I've been waiting for 2 months? What's your idea of terrible?
Don't you want to meet Larry Renault? That's better than going to a movie.
That has been.
And Carlotta Vance?
And Jenny Lind, is she coming?
Now, Ed, Millie's done a lot of things for us. Helps her with my clothes. Besides, who can you get at 6:45 but relatives?
All right. I'm a relative and I'm here. Come on, let's get it over with.
We're talking about rules of etiquette, how they change and how we make sense of them here on The Connection this hour. With me on the program, Sally Quinn, author and reporter with The Washington Post, author of, incidentally, The Party, A Guide to Adventurous Entertaining. Jesse Browner's also with us. He's author of The Duchess Who Wouldn't Sit Down, An Informal History of Hospitality. And Martin Bu is also on the program. He's a contributor to the Los Angeles Times Magazine and to Bon Appetit. And Martin, one of the things that you were saying earlier to a person on our program is that the guest has certain obligations here. I've always really thought of this type of entertaining as something that's really up to the host, but you think the guest needs to carry a little more water when it comes to this kind of social interchange?
Well, yeah, I do. And, you know, frankly, this is something I hadn't quite thought about until I recently wrote an article about guest behavior. But, you know, I used to be inclined to view the whole deal as I show up, try not to offend anybody, maybe have a nice conversation and leave. But, you know, when you think about it, a dinner party, a party, any kind of social gathering, it's really kind of a forum for where you're invited not only to the gathering, but it's your chance to seize the day and really try to connect with new people and, you know, kind of create a new kind of energy. And I think one example I wrote about is at Thanksgiving dinner a couple of years ago, a friend of mine sat down at the table and said, "What do we got to be thankful for? Nothing." And the bigger point being, it's one of the things we do is I think we can do as a guest is just kind of leave all of our quotidian burdens at the door and come in with a lighter spring in our step.
Jesse, is that an expectation that you have as a host, that your guests will at least give that amount of thought to how they participate in the evening?
Honestly, it isn't. I would have to say that I think the entire burden is on the host. You're preparing your evening. You're inviting what you hope will be the appropriate group of people. From the very first moment they step through your door, you're hoping you're working hard to relax them. And I think once they are relaxed and once they meet their peers, and if you've done everything right, they will almost automatically become voluble and entertaining. And then I tend to leave them to themselves. My job is sort of to act as a sweep, make sure that nobody's left out. But I don't think that the guests have any obligation. It's entirely burden of the host.
But Jesse, you write about the host's duty as including, you know, being manipulative and sly and duplicitous in order to create this ambience that you're describing.
Well, it's hard work. You know, people are coming in, say, on a Friday night. They've had a long week. It's a very dangerous world out there. They've been competing amongst each other all week long, and they're going to have a hard time relaxing. And you do need to be manipulative. That's not to say you need to lie to them or spike their drinks, but you need to create an artificial environment in which they are able to relax from the first moment they get there.
All right, Sally Quinn, you cater to a very tough crowd. What's your view of it?
Well, I feel I do expect something of my guest because I think that to be a host or a hostess is an act of generosity, and that to be able to make people have a good time and to create an atmosphere where they will have a good time is the host and hostess's obligation. And certainly I do everything I possibly can to make them feel warm and welcome and ready to have a good time when they walk in the door and have a sense of expectation that that will be done for them, and they will. But I do think that a guest has an obligation. When I go to a party, I feel absolutely that I have an obligation to hold up my end of the conversation and to keep things moving and keep things lively. And if people don't do that when I invite them to my house, then I don't usually invite them back because I don't, I mean, I will do everything I can to make sure that they're comfortable and they have a good time and there's a good group of people to be together. But if they don't participate, mm-hmm. I think it's not a one-way street entertaining. And if they don't participate and they don't make an effort, then I'm not really interested in seeing them again or having them in my house again.
All right, you three, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about rules as in etiquette or just sort of the responsibilities as we understand the way that we interact socially? I'm asking this because I want to get a better understanding of how quickly all this changes and how wide awake we have to be to adapting to this year and next year.
Well, you were asking earlier about etiquette, and I think for me, etiquette really is a way of being considerate of other people. I mean, I think that's it, simply, and that the rules of etiquette are there for a reason, and that is to make people feel comfortable and to make people feel confident in a social environment.
But none of that
and
changes, does it, Sally? But that's
what?
Being I said none of that changes. That's just being polite. That's holding
exactly.
a chair.
Exactly. That, but that, so, I mean, the overall, the idea of etiquette overall will never change, whether you're having somebody to sit in your kitchen and have a cup of coffee or whether you're having a sit-down dinner for 250 in a dancing black tie. It's all the same attitude, which is you want to make your guests feel comfortable and easy and you want to be considerate of them, as well as the guest's responsibility to be considerate of their host. But as times change, then so do the rules of etiquette. And that, I mean, the rules of etiquette change just as the way people dress changes. But the point of dressing well is to please other people and please yourself, to feel good about how you look and to have other people be aesthetically pleased by the way you look. The same thing for etiquette, too.
Casual elegant. I wish somebody would tell me what casual elegant means. Is it just a clean way of saying no jeans?
Casual elegant is a white satin blouse with black silk pants and pearls.
I look terrible in pearls. <You know? laughs>
Well, I have to say I agree with Sally completely. I think that these are tools that we use in every aspect of our lives, not only in a dinner party situation. We all intuit what other people expect from us. I don't think they're rules that we necessarily need to learn any more than we need to learn the rules of grammar in order to speak correctly. Etiquette evolves according to the needs. And just the way language does. We don't really need to learn it. We just need to be considerate, generous people, and everything else will come naturally
after
that.
But the rules do have to adapt at some level, Jesse, because 10 years ago, people would push back their chairs at a dinner table and light up a cigarette. And now, that in most places, that wouldn't happen.
Well, they're still able to do that at my house.
I forgot. New York. Okay.
I don't forbid anyone to smoke, but I find that no one smokes in my house ever. And I have ashtrays everywhere. And whenever if I have a large party, like a buffet or supper or a cocktail party, people who want to smoke go out on the porch, or even in the middle of winter. Without being asked. And I can't remember the last time anybody's lit a cigarette at the table. I mean, I just can't. When we used to live in Greece, my father was in the military, and I remember one night my father went to a dinner party at the British Embassy, and the British ambassador, my father was sitting at one end of the table, and the ambassador was at the other table, the other end, and my father lit up a cigarette after the first course, which was the done thing in those days. People smoked between courses and there were ashtrays. And the ambassador leaned down at the end of the table and he said, "General Quinn, in this house we do not smoke until after the suite." And my father said, "Well, Mr. Ambassador, in my house a guest can do no wrong." And about two or three weeks later, the ambassador came to dinner at our house and he got so drunk that he fell off his chair. That's really not the right thing to do either. But I mean, as far as smoking, I agree. It used to be that there were ashtrays on tables everywhere. Now I never see that. And I don't put ashtrays on the table anymore.
Martin, what about the evolution here? Go ahead. Sorry,
as far as the smoking thing, I mean, you'll get your fingers chopped off for trying to smoke in somebody's house around here. it's more of a like moral issue than etiquette. But you know, I was just going to go back to what we were speaking about a minute ago about the just the place for etiquette and does it come down to rules? You know, yeah. From my perspective here, having just written a couple of pieces that kind of went through some brass tacks questions we're talking about, it seems to me that etiquette is etiquette. It's all about generosity and hospitality. But people are definitely looking for some guidance here because, you know, I wrote this piece which ran on the cover about 3 weeks ago in the Times Magazine, and I was thinking, well, you know, what am I doing telling? I mean, people know how to start a conversation. They know when to get there and all this. And this thing came out, and people go, that was the greatest article because, you know, it's I don't know how to what to do when I forget someone's name. And I'm like, you don't? It's like, and the conclusion I arrived to was that, you know, through the 60s, I think a lot of the world, the country, you know, we kind of swept away all sorts of formalities and protocols, and we've been without them so long, I think people kind of want something to hang their hat on. They're really looking for guidance, and, you know, you see Martha Stewart doling out advice on all sorts of things in incredibly minute detail,
And you people know, gobbling kind of that up, yeah.
Gobbling it up.
Sally,
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's amazing to me how many people feel socially insecure and always feel as if they're doing the wrong thing and that they don't know what the right, what fork to use and how to address somebody and how to start a conversation and what drink to serve. And always when I get asked these questions, it starts out, is it appropriate? And I always think that ultimately you should follow your instincts. It's not as a matter of whether something's appropriate, whether it feels right, whether you think it will please your guest, or whether you think it will offend somebody.
Wow, but come on now. You've got some good advice, Sally, on the question of a conversation. You say you use your skills as a reporter here.
Well, yes. When I'm seated next to someone at dinner, and, you know, I had some very heavy slogging at some of these parties, you know, particularly in the old days in Washington where men never paid any attention to women. The woman's job was to bring out the man and to talk about him and his work and all of that. And that used to be very tedious. But there's some people who just aren't good at small talk. And I, as a reporter, I find that I just start interviewing them, literally asking them questions about themselves and trying not to be in a prying way. And I find that when all else fails, one of the things we all know is that everyone has a dysfunctional family. And if you start on asking questions about the family, after about three questions, you're going to hit the mother load. You know, there's going to be the crazy aunt who's lived in the closet for the last 30 years, you know, or some horrendous story that will be absolutely riveting. And once people get started about their families, they get so emotional about it and they get so intense that they'll just start. You can't get them to shut up. So I find that is the sort of the final thing you can do if nothing else works.
Jesse, I wanted to ask you a question about wine a la New York. If you're invited out, do you always take a bottle of wine? Do you figure out if it's four people or 12 people that sit down buffet? How do you make those decisions?
For some reason, yes, I always bring a bottle of wine, and everybody always brings a bottle of wine to my house. I'm not quite sure how it became such a sort of de rigueur tradition, but people do. At the most, you would ask whether you're eating meat or fish, and then you might decide to bring white or red, or you base it on your own preferences. You can't really go wrong as long as it's a decent bottle of wine.
But you're a pretty careful host. You would also plan out the wine, so you don't feel obliged to put the wine that I bring on the table for the dinner that you've invited me to?
On the contrary, if it's a really good bottle of wine, I'll usually save it until after dinner.
Oh, but share it with everyone. I thought you were going to put it away.
No, let me tell you that every year I have a former colleague who's now retired, and for the past 10 years I've invited her to our Thanksgiving dinner. We usually have 25 to 30 people, and she's never able to make it because she has other family obligations, but she always sends along two bottles of spectacular wine. And that wine goes straight behind the bookshelf, and I share it with my father-in-law. And I suppose I probably shouldn't have said that since some of my relatives will be listening to this.
Martin, what's the drill with you and wine? Will you try and get it on the table if it's brought, or if you bring it, do you expect to see it on the table?
I think that depending on how well choreographed your particular dinner is, that it's perfectly acceptable to set a bottle of wine one of your guests may have brought aside if it's not appropriate to serve with dinner. You probably have to gauge whether or not they really wanted to drink that bottle of wine with you at dinner, in which case you probably ought to serve it. I run a pretty loose ship when I entertain, though. I mean, I tend to have it be pretty casual.
So you'll ask?
Rustic. Pardon me?
I said, so you'll ask whether or not they want it opened or not? Or when you
Yeah. I think
well,
that's
they'll usually let you know anyway.
Yeah, it's my friends anyway. It's like, you know, they're like, are you going to open that damn wine or what?
Sally, do you take wine to a party?
I never bring wine unless I've, what I might occasionally do is bring a bottle of champagne. But because I never know what they're going to serve and or how many people, or most of my friends already have their wine and have planned the wine, what wine they want to use for dinner. I mean, I think it's a nice gesture, but I certainly never feel obligated to drink it the night that I serve a dinner. I would just usually, because if it's one bottle and you're serving six bottles of something else, unless somebody says, this is a really fantastic wine, let's all taste it, or makes a point of saying, I wish you would try this, then certainly I would. But I don't feel any obligation to do that.
Do you take anything? Flowers,
I've never
chocolate,
felt...
tropical fish? Do you take anything to a dinner?
I don't take gifts to dinner parties. I mean, there's some people who will bring flowers, you know, sort of like a bunch of flowers and hand them to you at the door. And there you are trying to greet your guests and get things organized. And you've got to run into the kitchen and get a vase and fill it up with water and put the flowers somewhere. So I don't do that. And one of the problems with bringing presents is that often the cards get lost. And so you don't even know who brought the present. You can't thank them for it. So I would rather send something later.
Our listeners are scribbling all this down. I'm listening, as we all are on the New Year's Eve, to a show about etiquette. And we will be back after this break to talk more about what to do and what not to do. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. On New Year's Eve, you're listening to the etiquette edition of The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. With me on the program this hour, Martin Boo, contributor to the Los Angeles Times Magazine and to Bon Appetit. Jesse Browner, author of a new book called The Duchess Who Wouldn't Sit Down, An Informal History of Hospitality. And Sally Quinn, author of The Party, A Guide to Adventurous Entertaining. Sally's an author and a reporter with The Washington Post. And we're talking about etiquette. We're also talking about what we should say at parties.
Look, you want to be able to talk to people in this town? Well, in Washington, everybody says exactly the same things at every party. You just have to know the right responses. If you learn these eight sentences, you'll be a hit at every party.
Are you kidding me?
No. Those eight sentences cover just about everything anybody talks about in this town. It's the great Washington art of sounding like you know what you're talking about when you don't know zip. Go ahead, read the first one.
Okay. Here's what I'd like to know. Who elected the Washington Post president?
That one applies about 80% of the time.
Okay. Number two. We can't be the policemen of the world, but until we get another cop on the block, we have to support our friends.
That one comes up a lot. Number three.
Being a superpower has a price.
Now you can use that one with number two and number four. Read number four.
Number four, it's still a dangerous world.
Read number five.
Number five, that's about as likely as a Democrat being elected president.
That's Melanie Griffith, born yesterday. How close is that, Sally, to what actually happens?
Well, do you realize that I was in that movie?
No.
Yes. My husband and I did cameo appearances in that movie with Don Johnson and Melanie Griffith. He played the Secretary of the Navy, and I played his wife, and we had a party, and our party was filmed. We went out to L.A. and did the whole thing on the set. I was the party advisor.
I like that. So these lines are dead on, then.
Those lines are pretty good. I mean, they stand up pretty well, I must say.
I want to find out what you do with a guest who goes bad. Martin, have you ever thrown
him out?
Yeah, you would throw him out.
Well, I don't think I've ever thrown anybody out, but I was at a party earlier this year. It was a publication party for a book that a couple of us were anthologized in, and the editor of the book was a rather stentorian fellow who tends to really just, suffice it to say, by the his 45 minutes after his arrival, he had caused this kind of panicky migration of the 18 or 20 people who were there from kitchen, dining room, living room, back to, he was like this border collie herding sheep. And it got to the point where I kind of went outside on the patio for a little bit, and the next thing I knew, the host of the party, my friend Lou, had kind of hustled this man out the door, and the last words spoken were, "And take your stupid hat." Now, you know, the main crime this man had committed was by just holding the floor, just, you know, sucking all the oxygen out of the room, and So this was a very interesting thing to behold, because I don't know that any of us had really seen anyone physically thrown out of a party. I mean, it wasn't violent or anything, but so this kind of sparked a good deal of conversation, and we kind of was like, "Lou, don't you think that was a little bit harsh?" And Lou bellowed, "Am I the last defender of etiquette?" In retrospect, I'm kind of in favor of it, because it ups the ante. It makes going to a party, you know, there's something at stake there. I think
more
it's good to know that you could offend someone enough to be tossed out of the joint.
Jesse, you tell a story about a guest who was either knowingly or unknowingly insulting your wife, and yet you wouldn't throw that guy out.
No, I think you'd have to do a lot worse than that. I had to leave the room to control myself. But at the time, I have to say, I was the only one who was upset by it. And so it was natural for me to leave the room. And of course, he came in later and apologized. But I can't imagine any situation where I would have to throw somebody out. Perhaps it exists, you know, if I were Penelope and my guests didn't leave for 10 years, I might consider it. But other than that, you know, the great French writer Brillat Savarin says that as long as somebody is in beneath your roof, you are responsible for their happiness. And for me, that's kind of the cardinal rule of hospitality. It's almost impossible to imagine what somebody would have to do to get thrown out.
What if they're ruining the party for everybody else, though? Then well, your loyalties are divided.
I have to say, I think I'd have to cross that bridge when I came to it. 20 years of giving dinner parties, I can't say I've ever been in that situation. It's not impossible.
You're being too careful about who you invite.
I think I must be, yeah.
Judicious. Sally, what about you?
I've never had to throw anybody out. I mean, sometimes people will talk too much and overstay their welcome, but I always allow my husband to deal with that. Ben just stands up and says, "I'm going to bed." And everybody forgives him for that. If I did it, people would be horrified. But he does it, and everybody says, "Oh, there's Ben, you know, I guess it's time to go." And they kind of jolly, they're all jolly, and they get up and they leave. But Joan Rivers once told me a very funny story that she had this horrible guest at one of her parties who was completely obnoxious and was insulting everybody and got very drunk. And she went around and whispered to all the other guests to pretend to leave and then go hide in the bedroom. So one by one, they all said good night, thank you so much, and they all would go hide in the bedroom. And finally, he was the only one left. And she said, "Well, I guess, you know, this is it. Everyone seems to have gone." And she sort of ushered him out the door. And once he was gone, they all came out of the bedroom and kept on partying. I thought that was quite brilliant.
Does it mean that you actually get to lie in aid of keeping a good party going?
Yep. That's what it means.
Yeah.
And hypocrisy is the glue of civilization.
All right, Jesse, this brings us back to being sly and duplicitous, I guess, in the aid of the good party.
Well, of course, Penelope, again, I'm sorry to keep bringing her up, but she's sort of the archetype of hostesses. There she is, besieged by suitors for 10 years while her husband is trying to make it home. And every night, she unravels the weaving that she's done during the day, I think she's sort of a perfect representation of what the host has to do. She has to smile to their faces and completely undo them behind their backs. It's a question of control. If you're going to have a successful party, you really have to be in control of every aspect, and that includes, to a certain extent, the behavior of your guests. It's a very difficult thing. I was thinking of this story that Audubon writes about in his biography. He received a guest, a fellow naturalist, and on the very first night that his guest arrived, he wakes up in the middle of the night to find his guest standing naked on the dining room table, smashing bats with Audubon's prize Cremona. Now, Audubon, you might think there would be a good opportunity to throw somebody out, but instead what he did was he presented him with drawings of fictional fish, 10 fish from the Ohio River, and this man published them in his study of the fish of the Ohio River, and it destroyed his entire career. So,
because,
you know,
the fish didn't exist.
But the fish didn't exist. They were completely made up, and, you know, so there are worse things to do to a guest than throw them out.
Tell me, let's go around the table once on this one, because you guys are all good observers of or throwers of interesting parties. What's the magic that you can think back to that made one party particularly sparkle? Is it figuring out something as simple as where people sit or the number of people or the mix? I don't know. Sally, what's one of your favorite little trade secrets here?
Well, I think that the magic for any party is to have a reason to celebrate. I don't ever have a party for no reason. And I have to make up a reason, you know, if it's Groundhog Day. But I just think that people like very much to come together to celebrate something. And it's sort of ceremonial in a way. It's traditional. It's a ritual. And probably the best party that I ever had was for my husband's 70th birthday, and we had it down in Southern Maryland, and it was sort of like a whole weekend, and then there was this party, and everybody was really happy to be there and celebrate him, and it was very emotional, and there were a lot of speeches, and people just felt really happy to be there, and he was happy that they were there, and he loved all his guests, and they loved him, and it just made people feel special. And I think that when you're celebrating somebody that you care about, it mm-hmm. makes everyone feel wonderful, and it gives the party a huge lift.
Martin, what's your trade secret here?
Invite some Italians to be there talking when everybody comes in, because you know, it's like lighting the fireplace. For my 40th birthday party, which was thrown by a friend of mine who lived in Italy for a long time, and some of her, well, our mutual Italian friends got there first. It was the best thing that ever happened to a party, because people speaking Italian. I mean, you're halfway there.
did the volume or the pitch or the speed of the conversation have something to do with it, or was
just
it
the warmth of it? And these were very warm people. I mean, it's like I'd hate to revert to a craven cliche like, you know, Italians are warm, but you know, they are, mostly, except for
they know how to party.
Yeah, they know, and it's like, you know, they make you feel really good whether they like you or not. And so yeah, I just always, that's one of my aphorisms, is make the Italians come first. You want to have a good party? Bring on the Italians.
Invite them for 7 and everyone else for 8.
I was going to say, the other thing, though, it's like you ask about, you know, the size and configuration and all of that. You know, I can think of I do think that really, you know, unless you're throwing a huge bash, that, you know, 8 to 12 people seated around a table, preferably balanced by gender, if you can get a nice conversational flow where somebody kind of brings something up, everybody else kind of remarks on it, then you move on and it's kind of equal participation, that makes for a really nice get-together.
And you can sense that when it's happening. You can sort of
absolutely
feel that in the room. Yeah.
Yeah,
because
I have to...
Sorry.
No,
for
sorry.
Cocktail parties.
Go ahead, Sally. I'm sorry.
All right, I'll go quickly. Yeah. For cocktail parties, I think it's really important to invite more people than will fit into the room comfortably, so that everybody is just packed in there like sardines, and they all feel like they're at where action is. This is the place to be. There is nothing worse than going to a party where the room is too big and people are sort of floating around thinking, nobody came, you know, what am I doing here?
I never knew why the pack of a room had that attraction to it. Now I've got that. Thanks for that, Jesse.
Well, you know, restaurants are. I'm sorry to interrupt. Restaurants are designed around that concept, though. You know, it's like you want a certain energy level in a restaurant because otherwise, people, oh, the place is deserted. The food can't possibly be any good. And I think the same principle applies to to a party or a cocktail party, anyway.
All right, Jesse, what's your secret for us on entertaining that has worked particularly well at the Browner household?
Well, honestly, Dick, I wish I could say I had a secret. There are certain elements that are necessary. I think the mix of people is absolutely essential. But unfortunately, I leave that to my wife because she's much more social than I am. Good food goes without saying. All of those things are important. But in the long run, when it all clicks, when it all comes together and you're sitting at the end of the table and everybody's deep in conversation, there's something ineffable about it. You can't really say why at that moment it's worked out perfectly. I can remember, for instance, Thanksgiving of 2001. You know, we live in Lower Manhattan within view of the World Trade Center. And 2 months later, we still had to keep our windows closed because of the smell. And that Thanksgiving, there was something there that could never, ever be duplicated again. It happens at other parties, too, for happier reasons, hopefully. But in the long run, I think it's like art. You can't really define what the binding element is that makes something work when almost all the same ingredients did not work the week before.
Jesse, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
My pleasure.
Jesse Browner is author of The Duchess Who Wouldn't Sit Down, An Informal History of Hospitality. Martin, thanks a lot for taking the time out of your day to be with us.
My pleasure.
Martin Bu is a contributor to the Los Angeles Times Magazine and to Bon Appetit. And Sally Quinn, thank you for braving the Washington weather to join us.
It was fun. Thanks.
Sally Quinn is an author and reporter for the Washington Post, author of a book most recently, The Party, A Guide to Adventurous Entertaining. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.